Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us for a personal tour of How Homeopathy Helps to Grow Great Gardens, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath, Debbie Brock, and international expert agro-homeopath, Kavi Raj. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with Kavi Raj Vaikuthanam, the author of the international best-selling book, Homeopathy for Home and Garden. Today is November 3rd, 2010, and you're listening to show number 3 of How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens. Please do visit us on Blog Talk Radio. There is a space over there to place your comments and or questions, to favorite, and to listen to the archive shows that we've done in the past. The last show, we learned how to apply the homeopathic remedies and the proportions of the remedy to the water, and to allow the application to seep around the roots. Listeners, don't forget, the listeners can download the archive from the last show to learn what we spoke about. Kavi, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, Debbie.
Great.
Can you hear me well?
I hear you. And
the sound is good.
The sound is okay, and now we're going to move on to some, I think, things that are itching us, some things that are getting under our skin and bugging us. First, I wanted to know if there was anything in the southern hemisphere that the gardeners need to take note of in terms of their weather conditions now, and if maybe they have some bugs to be concerned about.
Well, yeah, I would say if you are preparing your garden for spring, then of course you first have to make the beds in which you plant your seeds or your seedlings. And in order for them to remain free of weeds, as we said last week, use the Euglans nigra or the Euglans regia, and spray it on the garden 48 hours before you plant anything. And that will stop the weeds for at least 3 to 4 months. We did a test here at the estate where I'm living, and for actually 5 months, we didn't see any weeds. Yeah, and the weeds that were there, they remained small. They didn't grow. They didn't want to grow. So that is a perfect means to stop the weeds from overcrowding all the flowers and the vegetables that you like to grow. And in regards to bugs, if you whatever you plant, like if you plant tomatoes, give it a dose of basilicum, because basilicum and tomatoes belong together in the garden, in the kitchen, and also in Materia Medica. Everybody knows that when you eat tomatoes and you add a little bit of basil, the taste becomes better. If you add some basil as a homeopathic remedy to your tomatoes, you will also get a better taste from them. They will grow bigger, and they will have no bugs and no diseases.
Okay. So the basil plant, so can you tell us a little bit more about the method that you use for spraying, the proportions, and how we prepare the, do we do it, what kind of a spray container do you use?
I generally use a watering can. Excuse me.
Okay.
I use
okay,
a watering
so when
can.
You when you say spray, you don't mean specifically spray like in a spritzing bottle or a what is the big
no.
Okay, you're what saying
I do,
you
what
just
what I do is water the roots. Yeah, because plants have their mouth in the ground. They drink through their roots. We drink through the mouth. We don't spray the remedy on our faces. We take it in our mouth. In the same way, you treat the plants. You give it in their mouth. Yeah, because then it works better, and it works more immediate. And if you would spray the plant, then you only spray at the top, and usually the bugs hide at the bottom of the leaves. So then you don't do anything to the bugs. Yeah, so the bugs are not being affected. And if you give it to the plant through the roots, then the plant takes it up, and all the plant is being made immune against the bugs. So that works much better. Yeah, spraying is something that you can do when you have big trees and you have like molds. Yeah, then you can spray, but you should also water it in the roots. Yeah.
Okay, if you have besides the big trees, if you have what, what was that second thing you said?
If you have fungal diseases. Yeah,
okay,
like
fungal
mold.
Diseases. Oh, mold.
Yeah, like,
okay.
Yeah.
You know what? This is maybe, I don't know if anybody's, this is not the time of year that people are worried about it, but tent caterpillars, they really can cover an entire tree and all the leaves are lost, and there's a big problem with that. What do we still water from the roots of the tree?
Yes, you still water on the roots. Actually, what you call tent caterpillar is also called the procession moth. Yeah, it's because these caterpillars they gather at the bottom of the tree and they make a layer of silk into which they hide. That's why they're called tent caterpillars. Yeah? And once they have denuded the tree, once they've eaten all the leaves, they walk in a line to the next one. And that's why they're called procession caterpillar.
Oh, procession.
Yeah?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And they are pretty dangerous, too. Don't touch them because you can get very terrible rashes from it. In Materia Medica is a story, in Clark's Materia Medica, a boy, he shook some out of a tree, and they fell on his naked chest, and 4 hours later, he was dead. Yeah, so these things, they secrete a poison through the hairs, yeah, that can be deadly, especially for young children. So there is a remedy called Sambucus nigra. Sambucus nigra is the box elder, yeah, which is used also as a hedge. Yeah, if you take the leaves of that and you make a decoction of it, that's how they did it in the past, and then they sprayed that on their plants, and then no caterpillars would come. You can use it also in the potency, so you don't have to go through the trouble of making a decoction. Yeah, if you use it in the potency, it works just as well.
Okay. So I'm getting
some
a hint that whenever I hear you say spray, this really is an indication that we're just making an application to the roots in most cases, except for special indications when there
I
is a tree.
Water it on the roots.
Okay. I just want to make sure I'm learning the proper way of application.
Yeah, everybody is always talking about sprays with these things because the poisons are always sprayed. So I use that term so that people understand what we're talking about. But actually, I should say water on the roots.
Okay, we're going to rephrase ourselves. Yeah,
that's
great. And as a matter of fact, I did want to ask a special question regarding this organic method of gardening as a counterpoint to the typical way that we're told in other media and gardening how we should run out to the store and get some insecticides. Can you give us like a little difference on what happens to the plants and what happens to our gardens when we do it either an organic method or inorganic?
If we use the regular method, the chemical method, as I call it, then indeed you run off to the store and you buy your pesticide and you spray it on the plant. But because the pesticide is a poison, the plant gets also poisoned. Yeah, it enters through the pores in the leaves and it will slow down its growth and it will do a few other things. It will poison the soil in your garden. It will poison the waterways. It will poison the groundwater. Yeah, and it all goes into the food chain. Yeah, so the things that you have poisoned may be eaten by birds, and the birds, they get poisoned as well, which are in turn eaten by other birds or by foxes. Yeah, and they get poisoned, who get in turn eaten by other animals again. And so it goes up in the food chain. And the higher it goes up in the food chain, the more and the greater is the accumulation of poison. Yeah, so that is not good at all. And if you use...
And people don't realize what they're
doing. No, they don't realize that because they're not being
told. They don't realize what they're doing by application. They think they're just growing a better, greener lawn, and they think that they're just taking care of their one tiny little plant in their garden, but that it seeps through the water and it goes down and collects everybody in the neighborhood doing it. It collects into a tremendous quantity.
Yes, indeed. And if you look in the drinking water of big cities anywhere in the world, then you see that the drinking water is containing these pesticides because they cannot filter it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They cannot filter it out.
No, the drinking water that you get from the tap, yeah, is not filtered out. It is full of things. It is also full of hormones. It is full of Prozac, it's full of antibiotics, and it's full of pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides. So it's no longer drinking water, really. You wouldn't even give it to your plants, let alone drink it yourself. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that is because these things, they cannot be filtered out.
What do we drink, Javi? What do you recommend?
Well, you know, most people nowadays buy bottled water, but bottled water is all plastic bottles, and that's also not so smart. Yeah.
Right.
What I recommend is that you actually the only way to get it out there is to distill it, and then you will have to add oxygen into it because otherwise distilled water is also not drinkable water. Yeah.
Well, we've really gone a little bit off topic, but I wanted to. I use reverse osmosis. Is that okay? Is that okay?
Yeah, that is another way to do it. Reverse osmosis and a couple of good filters, not only charcoal filters, but finer even than charcoal. Yeah, that is the way to do it. But
okay,
we were talking about
that's how the plants do it, don't they? Copy.
Yes,
that's how the plants do it. They have reverse osmosis built in naturally to their system.
Exactly, but then they still cannot get rid of all these poisons. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so the difference with homeopathy is that you run to the store and you buy a homeopathic remedy and you give it to the plant and the plant gets strengthened by it. And the plant grows bigger and the fruits that come from it are juicier, bigger, and tastier.
Well, you're making it very appetizing.
Yes,
I was
it is.
Yes, it is. Okay.
Yeah.
I think that covers about the Southern Hemisphere, that they're getting ready to plant their seedlings, and hopefully they'll have a little bit of rain to water in there from heaven, their plants. And when we give them their homeopathic strengtheners, they're going to get some good crops that will start to grow quicker and less die off and dampening off of their seedlings. And we talked a little bit about bugs and you're still watering around the roots to give them strength and protect themselves. And what about we could just hand pick off bugs if we see them, unless they're toxic, like you told us don't touch those.
Those caterpillars, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to tell a story. And next time I'll tell a story about how I was touched something, and boy, it put me out. But let's say, let's go on to the bugs issue. I feel like bugs are everywhere in the news, and there's some specifically that are, we want to find out about aphids, mites, stink bugs, and bed bugs. And maybe you could start off a little bit about mites. And there's just, you know, when I know my children are allergic to mites in the house, and it contributes to asthma in children. What about the mites in the garden? Are they a different species? And what signs tell us that they're there? And how do we find them? What harm can they do to our plants? And how can we handle mite infestations?
Well, the first thing is that they are a different species. They are called spider mites. And they weave like real spiders. They weave these little threads, yeah? Only they don't make a nice web. They do it more like the tent caterpillar. They make big entanglements, and they draw the leaves and the branches of the plant together and suffocate it. Yeah, so you can always see there are these threads, these gray threads of the webbing that are in your plants, and that's a sign of spider mite. And spider mite is many times very, very small. Yeah, the biggest ones may be 2 millimeters, so they will be hard to detect with the naked eye. You will have to go in there with the magnifying glass to see them. Yeah, and so...
Okay.
They suffocate the plant, and the plant can no longer grow. And, of course, the plant doesn't like that. Now, there are several remedies for that. I shall have to grab my book for a second and have a good look at what the remedies are there. Yeah.
Okay. So if anybody's using your book, it would be great if you could... tell us where we're going to find that information in your book, Homeopathy for Home and Garden.
And for Farm and Garden.
For Farm and Garden. Homeopathy for Farm and Garden. And you'll tell us also where we're going to look that up in what section of the book when you get it. And I'm...
Yeah.
You know, the thing about spider mites is they're very obvious in their, in the end product of what they're doing, of the crinkling up of the rolling up of the leaves and how you see their entangled webs. But you don't see them because they're so minute and, like you said, in almost microscopic. But we can see the remnants of their work. And in a way, this is very homeopathic in the fact that when we look in our bodies and we see symptoms, it's also, it's not, the disease is not the symptom. Is that right? The disease is deeper than the symptom.
The mite is actually a sign that something is wrong with the plant. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The plant is having
right.
the problem, so we need to treat the plant and not chase the mites. Because if we chase the mites, we are on a wild goose chase. Yeah. We may be able
right.
to get rid of the mites for a while, but then very soon they will be back. Yeah,
right, and this is the same way for humans.
Yes. That's the same way. If you have a cold and you treat it with an acute remedy, the next time you will have again a cold. So you will have to go in there constitutionally to avoid that you get colds altogether. In the same way with plants, if they are having bugs all the time, something is wrong there that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. So I think for all newcomers, even though they may be hobbyists in the garden or even if they're organic gardeners, these types of principles are quite new and revolutionary and revealing to people of a different way of thinking. And it's taken me a good long time to really bring that home into my own being, into my own thinking process, that when we have, we exhibit these symptoms, that is not the core of the disease. And it's okay.
So with mites, you can do an emergency thing, which is to use Allium Sepa or the onion. Yeah, that is for the emergency, to get rid of them immediately. But then after a while, you will have to follow that up with something like Magnesia Fos, which is the constitutional treatment for the plant.
Okay.
Yeah. So the remedies that we can use, for the acute manifestation like Allium Sepa and some others, we can better use actually afterwards something so that the problem does not recur. And in plants, it is always an elementary substance that is the constitutional remedy for them. Because for the plants, those elements are actually daily food, as well as maintenance. Yeah. And so magnesium phosphoricum is a remedy that you can give to the plant after the mites, so it won't get mites again.
Okay. So list that first one for the acute situation when you see a massive amount of mite infestation. We're going to apply Allium Sepa. Was there another one?
Yes, there should be more. Salvia officinalis is another one that you can use
salvia.
For that. Yeah, and you can use Ricinus communis when you have it in your vine crops, like cucumbers or watermelons, but also in your grapes. So any vine crop, Ricinus communis is the remedy. Ricinus communis is also called castor oil.
Castor oil.
Yes, the castor oil plant.
Castor bean.
There is a remedy made from that, which is actually the best remedy for all vine crops, because the Ricinus communis is a companion plant to all the vine crops. And companion plants, they are also acting more or less like constitutional remedies, because they belong together. They are symbiotic with it. Yeah, they are symbiotic with the vine crops in this case. And then you have, let me see, there is another one here that is hyssop. Yeah, Hyssopus officinalis. Yeah, that is another one which you can use against the mite. And then you have... let me see. Tuya can also be used against the mite. The tuya.
Tuya. Okay,
yes,
so that's T-H-U-J-A. So people don't know exactly what it is. I wanted to spell it out for them.
That is actually a conifer that we use very much in our gardens as a tree. Yeah. We make hedges with the trees. Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, there is a remedy called Bovista, which is the worted puffball that is a fungus. Yeah.
Right.
There is also a remedy that can be used against it. And then there is a remedy made from. A predatory mite, and it's called Emblisaeus cucumeris. Yeah, or Emblisaeus mackenzie. Yeah, and you can order that from the IPM company. And last week we spoke about how you can make a remedy out of that yourself. Yeah. So if people want to know how to make those remedies, then they should actually get the previous show in which it has been explained.
Yeah. Okay.
Maybe we'll
put this information. Go ahead.
Yes. And then there is another one. It's called Trombidium Musca Domestica. That is actually also a mite. Yeah, and it's called that's a red mite, and it's also a predatory mite. Yeah, Clark, he describes it in the Materia Medica, and he says that it is actually he sees it as a parasite of the housefly, but actually no, the housefly is the taxi for the predatory mites, because the predatory mites, they don't walk around everywhere. They just grab the legs of the fly, and when the fly lands somewhere, then they let go, and then they have a new place where they can go look for prey. And if they don't find any, the next fly that comes, they will grab the leg again and travel somewhere else. So the fly is the taxi for the mite. And that's also how mites spread in the garden. You know, when bees and other insects come and land on a plant, the mite just grabs hold of the legs and then it flies somewhere else. That is how infestations also spread.
Wow, this reminds me of a hit movie, The Bees, or some of the other ones where they have little insects that are cartoon characters and we see the life of them, and this really would make a good movie. I'm just picturing them flying all around and getting their rides on different insects, on catching onto their legs and dropping into the new environments and spreading. Okay. I think that because these are Latin terms and scientific names of plants and insects and mites and all sorts of things, that on the blog we should describe them a little bit more and put the spelling up so that people can really get a little bit more study done. And so what I'm understanding from you, Kavi, is that when we have mites, they suffocate out on the they're suffocating the plant by building these entanglements, these webs, and they denude the leaves of the plant, and then they move on by catching a ride on other insects and dropping themselves into the next plant or the next section of your garden until you walk out there and it looks horrible. And then what we need to do for them is strengthen them by doing emergency care first with Allium sepa or salvia, or on the grapes, watermelons, or vine plants, use the castor oil and possibly the thuya or the bovista, the puff ball. And then there are some predatory mites that can be used also as against them. And finally, as a follow-up, once you've cleared up the acute situation, we use magnesium phosphoricum, phosphate, which one is that? And I'm sure they're wondering how or what is the potency that we use, and we're going to do the watering can method for this also.
And we always use the 6X or the 6C potency, because from tests that they have done in Brazil, they found out that some potencies work better than others, but the lower potencies, the below Avogadro's limit, they work the best.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I have some reports that they used a 6, a 12, a 30, a 200, a 1M, and a 10M. And then we read in these reports that when they use the 200 and they try that out on plants, that many times it has the opposite effect of what they want to achieve, because the potency is too high. The plant has a different vibration pattern, And because the plant does not really have a mind like we have, higher potencies are not very very workable for them. They like the lower potencies. Yeah. Although the first time that I treated rust, I used the Belladonna 200, and that worked like a charm. Yeah. But
so you're saying,
plants,
but that 200
some plants
works.
Don't like it. Some plants don't like it. Other plants like it. Yeah. My experience would say that trees have less problems with the higher potencies, whereas the smaller plants that we use for our vegetables are actually too small to withstand any higher potencies. They it disagrees with their vibration pattern.
That is totally awesome, enlightening, and amazing to me to think that it's kind of like a spirit level of the organic growing. I mean, whether you're an animal or whether you're a plant or whether you're a mineral, what's going to harmonize and support you the best is depending upon your soul level. I mean, even rocks and plants, to me, in my own thinking, they have some kind of a soul energy because they've materialized into the world, and yet on the basic level, the plants that are so fragile and delicate and next to the earth, they have the most low potency frequency that's going to help them and assist their growth and strengthen them, while as a plant that grows for hundreds of years, if it's a tree and grows rings and absorbs a lot about what's going on in the world, that's going to have a higher frequency. And just like humans over generations, we have the highest frequency, I would imagine. I'm getting really off topic into the spirit world, but this is really a fascinating subject. Okay.
Yes.
Do you have a comment about that?
As far as I can see, what you are saying is because the trees grow for so much longer, they absorb a lot more influences from the environment, and so they are spiritually speaking, I would say they are more robust. Whereas an annual or a biannual plant, that's pretty soon finished, So it is not so robust. It doesn't have that strength of spirit to maintain itself over a longer period. And then you can say, okay, there is bushes that live for many years and that stay small also. Yes, but they are bushes. They are the woody plants, so to speak, are having a stronger life force and pick up more things from the environment, whereas the vegetables, because they are so short-lived, they don't have that kind of thing. They don't go woody either. They stay soft and succulent. Yeah, and so when something is soft and succulent, any influence from the outside will easily penetrate. Just like a little child, when a little child catches a cold, it will be affected more than when a grown-up is catching a cold. We can keep going on, and a child may be in the bed for some time. It is more fragile. Uh-huh. And so we know from homeopathy for people that we give little children, we give the lower potencies in acute diseases, because they work better. So in the same way, the lower potencies also work better in the plants that are annual or biannual.
Go ahead. I don't want to cut you off there. Go ahead.
They're more sturdy. They have more staying power, and so when they take on something, it goes deeper inside, you could say, and therefore it needs a higher potency to extract that and throw it off.
Okay. I was just realizing that because that these soft succulent vegetables are short-lived, we also, when we harvest them, and we need to eat them and get their life force from them more directly, and they won't last, you know, they will, they're perishable. They won't last for that long, and that's why it's good to eat them when they're most fresh. And so this also tells us that we're not supposed to transport. We're supposed to eat local and not to transport. Yes. And that's a whole other story. I want to go back to our bugs. But we, you know, whatever we say, there's always something important in the way we live our life. And that we learn these lessons from the plants.
Well, actually, all these things have, of course, a bearing on everything. Yeah, it's because they are perishable; they have to be consumed as fresh as possible. Yeah, because otherwise, the life force goes out of them. Yeah.
Mhm. Yes. Okay. Let's go back to our
nuts. Nuts and apples, yeah. we can keep for years. We can even dry apples, yeah. And you know, so many fruits can be eaten as dried fruits, and they're still good. Yeah, but you can't do that with vegetables.
Okay, let's move on to some more buggy problems, because that was really supposed to be the topic of the show today.
Yes.
It's not exactly the bed bug problem. I'm going to kind of take us inside, because it appears to be very contagious. And how does this pest spread from home to home? I understand they are found in hotels. They were found in the Empire State Building.
Yes.
They're found in apartment buildings. There was actually a case where somebody won over like $100,000 because they had an infestation in their apartment building. They're spreading really, really quickly. Can you tell us what is happening? Let's see. There was one incident I was reading about in the federal government building where the bed bugs were discovered in the office of the United States Agency for International Development. And a spokesman who handled the PR for the case was not able to say exactly how they managed to get into the building, but it was a large problem. And it seems to be a question about how bugs can inflict harm on humans, and is there a confusion about these bed bugs and their relationship to scabies? And that is lots of questions all in one bunch. So see if you can sort that out a little bit.
Okay, let's begin with the beginning. Yeah,
okay.
Bed bugs. They usually live in furniture, and they travel from place to place by attaching themselves to people's clothes. You know how you wear pants, and the bottom of your pants is turned up. Yeah, so they hide it there, and then you go somewhere else, and you take your clothes off, and they are on the floor, and they creep over the floor and go into the beds and into the furniture at another place. Yeah. If anybody has bed bugs at home, and they may not be too aware of that. They may get bitten at night, and they may think it is something else. Yeah. And then the next day they go to their work, and they carry the bed bugs along in their clothes, and that is how it spreads in offices. Yeah. So bed bugs are not related to scabies. Scabies is a completely different creature. The scabies vesicle makes little tunnels in your skin, yeah, and then begins to itch, and then you scratch, and then you scratch somewhere else, then these same critters, they go on the other place, and they begin to tunnel there. But it usually begins on the hands, because that's where we catch them first, yeah. And they have little or nothing to do with the bed bug. The bed bug is not a carrier of scabies. Scabies is a completely different disease. They're both parasites, yeah. But scabies is more found on dogs, yeah. And bed bugs are found on beds, yeah. And scabies can be caught by animals from going into the wild. You know, you take them out in the forest, and there's another animal there that has it, and that's been rubbing itself along the plants, and your dog is passing there, and that's how the dog is getting it. Yeah. So there is a different route of contagion, as we would say. And the bed bugs in the house, well, there are different ways to get rid of them. All bugs hate camphor. Yeah. So if you use camphor in a low potency, like a 6X, and you mix that with a bit of liquid soap, yeah, and that is what you spray onto your furniture, yeah, also underneath, yeah, then the smell of the camphor, which is still there, yeah, which is too subtle for us to smell, but not so subtle that the bug cannot smell it, yeah, the bug will disappear. He doesn't like it. He will go somewhere else. And if you do that outside, you put them in the garden or on your balcony, and then you spray them, they will disappear. Don't do it in your house, because then they just disappear into the carpet, and they wait till the smell is gone, and then they're back into your furniture. Yeah. So do it in a place where they have an escape out of your house somewhere else. And camphor is the main remedy for that.
Okay. Camphor is the main remedy for the bed bugs, and the way that we get the bed bugs in the house is because we're out in the garden doing our thing, and they're out there,
Not out in the garden. Not out in the garden. The bed bug doesn't like it out in the garden. The bed bugs.
Oh, they hide in the dark.
Somebody who already had bed bugs, yeah, and carries them along in his clothes to his office, and there. You know, it goes into other people's clothes and goes into other houses, and they multiply there. They like the warmth, and they like the darkness of being under the bed. And as soon as the night falls and the lights go off, the bed bugs come out, and then they start biting people and they suck your blood. Yeah, a bit like fleas do. Yeah, so the bed
bugs. They're feeding.
They're feeding on you. Yeah, and that's why it is a parasite. But it will leave you as soon as the light comes on.
Oh, but it's not good for people to sleep with the light on.
No. And if they can hide in the folds of your clothes, they will do so. And then, you know, during the day in the office, you stick your feet under your desk, and there it's nice and dark, so he will creep out, and that's how he gets in the furniture into the offices. Yeah, and they'll find each other. You know, and they breathe like crazy. And so that's how it spreads.
Well, they're pretty sneaky. They're like cockroaches. They come out and to do their activity in the darkness, and then they scamper away when the light comes on. And I understand that they can hide in the most smallest of cracks and crevices, making the breeding sites. And once it's in the breeding site, we're wondering, how are we going to eradicate? And it's, you know, they tell us a lot of other things that we could do, supposedly, but that's not the best way. So if we use the camphor in the house, where will they go? I mean, will they just get out of your home?
Yeah, well, as I said, if you want to get rid of them, you take your furniture outside, and there you spray it with the camphor, and you leave it there. Yeah, and you say, and you use the camphor with a bit of liquid soap that will dry up, and so that will stick to the furniture, so that it keeps smelling of it. Yeah, so any ones that are in your carpet and want to get back into your furniture, they won't have the chance, because it will smell of the stuff they don't like.
I see. So our furniture, and the smell is very minute, because it's a 6X or 6C potency. We're not going to notice the smell at all. Only the bugs will.
No. And, yes, the bugs will.
Uh-huh.
And so And that is the way to do it. You take your furniture outside, spray it there, leave it for a couple of hours, and they will have gone. And then you take it back inside, and because of the smell of the camphor, the bugs will not come back to it. Yeah.
Well, what if I can't take my great big queen size bed outside? And you know, that's I'm thinking that the bed has they can really infest inside of the material that's made. The bed bug females lay 300 eggs, and the bed bugs hatch in 10 days. So do we have to do another application every 10 days?
Yes, you do that for 3-4 times, and then, you know, they won't have the chance to breed anymore, and they will be gone. If you do that 3-4 times, in about, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, you should be able to get rid of them completely. Yeah. And cockroaches you were talking about. So cockroaches, they can be gotten rid of by arsenic amalgam. Also in the 6X potency. Because we know that the cockroach is actually a really clean animal. It washes itself every 20 seconds. It licks itself completely clean. Yeah. Now, the funny thing is, if you give it arsenic is very fastidious. Then it becomes so fastidious that all it does is lick itself. And so it will die through lack of food. Yeah, because it will no longer go looking for food. Because actually, the cockroach is an arsenic animal. It cleans all the stuff that you leave behind. Yeah, so the cockroach is actually someone who helps you to keep your kitchen clean. Yeah. But at the same time,
that's a nice way to look at an animal that is kind of gross. Yeah, an animal that we don't think of it as very friendly, and it can harbor some diseases, can't it, or not? Am I mistaken?
Not that I know. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I have never seen
cockroaches
spread any disease. But you know, we don't like them because they are running everywhere. And there are bugs, and many people, they have some sort of aversion against bugs. Yeah.
When they run across your
actually,
pillow,
the best thing is never leave any food scraps. Yeah. Always clean your surfaces nicely, and then cockroaches have nothing to eat, and they will disappear anyway. And if they don't disappear, then give them arsenic. Give them arsenic and do that in the same way as the stuff for the bed bugs. Mix a bit with the liquid soap, and spray it on the surface and let it dry. Yeah, and very quickly.
Okay, I'm going to give that a try.
No more cockroaches in the house. I have given the same advice to Fran Sheffield in Australia, who's published it in her online homeopathic magazine. And people are using it, and they are completely amazed by it because it works.
Wow. And so we would look up Blatta orientalis? Is that
Blatta orientalis, Blatta europaeus, the German cockroach and the Asian cockroach. It doesn't matter where they come from. They all hate arsenic. Well,
okay.
Yeah, because they smell it and then they get induced to only groom, and when they only groom, they don't eat anything and they die.
Tricky.
And if you flatten them,
yes.
then they come. At the back of their bodies, they have these little eggshells. Yeah, inside at about 100 eggs. Yeah. So, if you flatten them, they are always pushed out, and then you have 100 new ones. Yeah, so don't flatten them. Just give them arsenic 6X, and they will go.
Okay, will they take it back into their home in the walls?
Yeah, they take it along with them because it sticks to their legs when they walk through it and they lick it, you know. And then something happens to them. And they disappear.
I love it. Okay.
Yes, so do I.
We have this is so great because we all have these problems, especially living in areas where there's tropical zones and humid areas when I don't even know, do they live through the winter pretty well or not?
In cockroaches, so yes. Anywhere it is warm, they survive. And you also have here the thing about stink bugs. Huh? Stink bugs are actually, you know... We have
about 10 minutes left for the
stink
bugs. Okay, go ahead.
Stink bugs are normally in the garden also. They are green, yeah. There are predators for the stink bug. Let me think. What was that again? There is a beetle,
a
predatory beetle that likes the stink bug very much and eats them for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Now I have to look up the name because it's out of my head.
Well, you'll think about it later. So stink bugs are a huge problem. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if they're the same problem in other countries, but they are in the United States and have gone just wild. They started in Pennsylvania. Somehow they got carried in. They're the brown marmorated stink bug, and we'll get a photo of that up there for people to take a look at. According to the Penn State entomology researchers, these shield-shaped pests were first collected in September of 1998. So they have been around quite some time, and they were predicted to have arrived a few years prior to captivation. They're native to Japan, Korea, and East China.
Yes.
But they have that predatory beetle must be living in those areas because that controls the populations there. They crawl along the grass, and they crawl along the grass, and many residents, including there was students at the Penn Manor in Pennsylvania, they were suffering from the stink bug invasion within the walls of their homes. And it seems that certain people are very much more sensitive to the odor that they produce, to the smell, which is supposedly quite stinky, and that's why it got its name.
Yes.
They swarm all over the place.
Yes.
The main thing, the reason we're talking about it is because they are a nuisance to farmers. They destroy their crops and their fruit orchards, their peaches, apples, figs, soybeans, field corn, tomatoes, and citrus fruits. So this is a problem for the growers, especially organic growers.
Yes. Now the thing is, there is this beetle, and there's also another beetle, which we use very much in homeopathy, which is called Cantharis. Cantharis can be used against them. Yeah, because Cantharis is actually also a predatory beetle. Yeah, and then there is another one. As I said, I have to look that up in my book. Let me see if I can find it. This is the version in there. The names are different.
While you're looking it up, I can tell a little bit more about the stink bug while you're looking that up. There was a gentleman named Tom Haas. He owned a Cherry Hill orchard and estimated 20% of his crop, his peach crop, was damaged, and he couldn't offer it for sale. So, therefore, you can see that it's really going to affect the profit margin and the harvest for all of these growers. And what he ended up doing was, I don't know whether this is good or not, he processed the fruit into juice, so that he could get a little bit of profit out of his growing season. There are many pest control businesses that are going to come in, and they're probably going to do some other kind of treatment that is not organic, that's not going to do, as we say, strengthen the orchard, strengthen the trees or the fruits. No known natural controls for the brown marmorated stink bug have been discovered based on the non-natural methods, whereas we're just learning from you that you can use these other beetles against them.
Yes. I'm just trying to find it.
Okay, you can keep looking, and I'll talk about this a little bit more. The non-discriminating chemical killers can be used as a short-term solution based on what you're going to read in the paper or be told by your local pest caretakers. Let's see, what are they called?
Integrated pest management companies, yes.
Yeah, integrated pest management companies, yeah. So one company is researching and producing an indoor trap for houses. The trap will attract the bugs using a pheromone chemical and confine them in one area as opposed to having them, okay, that's the stink bug, yep. As opposed to having them in the entire house. They'll still think they'll be located in one area if that you use a pheromone. This is a very popular mode of dealing with bugs, is using pheromones. And maybe we'll talk about that in a future show. We've got about 3 minutes left, and we're probably going to continue next week talking about the stink bug, because it's such a big problem and there's a lot of information here.
You can use some of the spider poisons like Aronia diadema or Latrodectus mactans, because the spiders they eat also all kinds of bugs. In the books that I have here, it's not been mentioned yet, and the only other book that I have that it is mentioned is what I have here on the computer. But it takes about 5-6 minutes to open up, because there's so many illustrations in it. So find that name so that next week we can at least give it.
Okay, can you tell me what book is it that has all the illustrations?
Farm and Garden? That is my new version of the English book, which is coming out next spring. Yeah, and that will be 600 pages.
600 pages in this volume,
yeah.
in a brand new volume that's going to have all of your
volume.
new research.
The first one was 200 almost, and the next one is going to be almost 600.
Well, that's threefold.
Yeah, so there's a lot of
information,
and I've completely changed the layout so that things are much easier to find. Yeah, things are organized according to plant families and then according to problems. So we have in one plant family, we have a section for pests, we have a section for diseases, and we have a section for nutrient problems, like that. So then the things are much easier to find. It will be much more user-friendly.
Okay. Well, we're going to close for today. This was our first time doing a full hour show, jam-packed with very important information for the organic gardener, for the homeowner, for the hobbyist, for the person who just loves plants, and those mites are just on their indoor plants. And so we really thank you from the bottom of our hearts for being with us and guiding us through organic gardening with homeopathy. And I'm looking forward to the next show already to learn more about the stink bugs. Okay, thanks,
yes.
Tavi.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Until next week. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to How Homeopathy Helps Grow Great Gardens with co-host, Kaviraj Vaikuthanath, and Debbie Bruck on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to get some sunshine and light up your life in your garden.